use the expression "my head exploded" far too often. I've tried to use it less, but I gotta tell you, my head has exploded over the last week in some good ways and some bad ways, but I think I put it back together enough for us to spend some time together and think out loud here on America Out Loud. I'm Pastor Rick Stevens. I'm the pastor of Diplomat Wesleyan Church in Cape Coral, Florida. We're a church like many other churches, full of good people, trying to do the best we can with what God has given us, and always eager to stretch in His direction. And I hope you are too, because that's what we do here. We stretch in God's direction. We try to challenge each other to have absolute confidence in the trustworthiness of God. That's what faith is all about. And we touch on a lot of aspects of that. And we're going to start today by touching on several aspects of that. You may be aware of diversity, equity, and inclusion. We're going to talk about that a little bit. You may be aware of the nonsense. Okay, you know how I feel about it. The nonsense going on with men participating and pretending to be women and participating in women's sports. We've got an update on that and a really good, strong statement from a university president. So I'm really pleased about that. And there's a few other things we're going to talk about. Some nonsense comes up every now and then. And one of my church people pointed this particular thing out to me related to the Declaration of Independence. So we'll get to that. But let's start here. I don't know that I mentioned it. Maybe I did a little bit that I was away for a while, about 2 weeks ago, I guess, is when I started. I lose track of time. But anyway, back then I was on a little trip, and it required me to miss a Sunday here at church. Well, that happens from time to time, and I'm thankful my church is very, very, congenial about that. They understand sometimes that happens. They're not difficult to get along with, and we always try to have a good guest speaker or some other kind of guest service, a special service to fill in when I'm gone. I always want it to be the kind of service that I wish I could be here for. I try to always have something really helpful and beneficial, and people would go away saying they were glad they were here, and they didn't really notice that I was gone. That's fine. I'm happy with that. Well, anyway, I was on this trip, and I spent a couple of days midweek. I guess I arrived on Thursday of that week in the Smoky Mountains. I like the Smoky Mountains. It's a refreshing place for me, and so I got to spend a couple of days there. And I had to miss Sunday, as I said, so I began to think about, well, where will I attend church? You know, I've been pretty consistent here on the program, admonishing all of us to show up for church every week. And so it's kind of important for me to practice what I preach, so to speak, or actually as I speak. And so I began to think about that, and I was aware of a church that we had attended one other time when we were visiting in the Smoky Mountains several years ago, and I thought, well, I could go to that church. That would be good, and I thought about that. I discovered there were a couple of churches within walking distance of the hotel where I was staying, and I thought, well, I could go to those churches, and I really hadn't settled on that. I kind of had an idea when I went on the trip, but the more I thought about it, I just wasn't comfortable with any of those decisions. I couldn't put my finger on it. I didn't know exactly why. But then I remembered that, well, I was going to have to be in Nashville on Sunday afternoon. And so what if I went to a church in the Nashville area? So I looked for a couple of ideas. And the ones I looked at that I thought I would find, I did not find. I'm not that familiar with Nashville, so I wasn't really surprised that I didn't come across what I kind of was looking for. But I knew of a church. I didn't know exactly where it was. I figured I could find it. But I knew of a church in the Nashville area because I had been reading with some regularity articles written by the pastor, who actually now is the former pastor. He retired. But his articles always reflected really good insight. You could tell he was a pastor from what he wrote. And I really benefited from that. And I appreciated that. So I thought, well, maybe it would be helpful to visit that church and see what it's about, because when the pastor has good things to say and seems to be on the right track with things, why not find out what that church is about? So I decided I would do that. So I got up early on that Sunday morning. It was a 3-hour drive from where I was to that church. I benefited from a time change, so I didn't really have any great stress to get there. But I'm pretty sure not too many of you got up and drove 3 hours to church any Sunday recently, did you? Well, that's okay. You don't have to do what I did. I just did that because I wanted to attend that particular church. Drive was easy. Got there in plenty of time. They have two services, one at 9:30 and one at 11. I got there kind of halfway between the wrong time to get there. And I discovered, and I wasn't really sure about this until I got there, but I discovered when I got there that this is a very large church. And I thought, well, that's okay. I've been to large churches. I wasn't intimidated by that. I was just kind of, okay, so that tells me something I didn't know. It's a large church. Then I turned in the parking lot, and because of when I arrived, there was no direction in the parking lot about where to go, where to find a parking place or anything like that, which I was fine. I'm not intimidated by that. I just kind of drove around looking for a parking place, which I did not find very easily. And I thought when I first turned into the parking lot, I thought, wow, this is interesting. I wonder why all these people come to this church. Because it was a big parking lot. Every parking spot that I saw as I drove around the church, I made kind of a counterclockwise loop around the church. That's just the way the parking lot seemed to go. And I noticed that all the parking places were filled. I said, why do people come to this church? Isn't this remarkable? I thought, well, I guess I'll find out. Well, I got on around to back toward the front of the church again, and there were some parking places there, not real close to the building, but that didn't matter. I could walk. I'm not afraid of that. So I parked, and at first I thought, well, maybe I won't go in right away because I was there at the wrong time. There was nobody out expecting a person to come to church for the 11 o'clock service as early as I got there. But I thought, you know, I want to see the place, so I may as well go in. So I went in and I looked around a little bit. I didn't nose around too much because I didn't want them to wonder what I was up to and cause anybody any heartburn about all that stuff, because I know churches are security conscious, and I didn't want them to wonder who is this stranger wandering around. So I went in. There was a place I could sit down there in the lobby, and that was fine. And so I managed to bide my time until it was time for church, and walked around a little bit more before the service started, and then finally decided, well, I'll go in and find a seat. So I walked in kind of the main entrance from that ground floor, and it was a huge church, huge auditorium, massive really. And as I walked in, I realized, well, I'm on the floor level, the first floor level, I guess you would call it. And I noticed they had a balcony, and I thought, well, I like balconies, so I'll go up to the balcony. And so I walked around and took the stairs up to the balcony. There were some people around. It wasn't terribly crowded because I was there kind of on the early side. And I found a seat. I decided I wanted to sit right in the center so I could see things because, well, you know how it is when you're, well, maybe you don't know how it is when you're a pastor, but as a pastor, I'll always go to church and I tend to see things through different eyes. And that's not a complaint. That's just a reality. I tend to see what people do, what churches do, and I ask why they do it, and all those kind of things. And that's fine. I've kind of made my peace with that and understood that. At the same time, I recognize it's a little difficult for me to be just a regular churchgoer, shall we say. So I went in and I found my seat. And again, I was early enough that I could look around and see what was going on. From where I sat, I could see everything I needed to see. I did notice when I walked in on the ground floor that the sound booth was in the correct place for a large room like that, so the people that actually operated the equipment could hear and see what they needed to. And that's not always the case in churches, but that one they did it right. So this getting time for the service to start, and I noticed they did things like a lot of churches do these days, put some announcements on the screen. They had an access to a digital bulletin, which I went ahead and accessed, and I watched as the people who were involved in the service began to take their place. And they had a full orchestra, strings, brass, everything. And I thought, yeah, that's not too surprising. Nashville area, a lot of music stuff, large church, a lot of opportunity for people to participate. I thought this is great, and it was. I thoroughly enjoyed that. And they came time, they began the service, and it began just kind of like lots of services begin. They didn't do anything during the service that I would describe as wow and amazement. They just conducted a service much like many churches do. And I know I haven't visited tons of churches because I kind of have a responsibility, but I have been in a bunch of churches over my lifetime, And this one was just a lot like many other churches. And I found myself drawn into the service. I did not overly analyze things. I paid as little attention to what they did and how they did it and the time it took them to do it, because I sometimes wonder about the time I take to do certain things. And I watched that and I began to notice that I felt drawn into the service, and I thought, what is this that I'm experiencing here? Why do I feel this way? Because I just don't know how to be a regular churchgoer. And then it dawned on me that what I was experiencing was what I would hope people experience in all the church services they go to. And I describe it in a way that I think I heard someone describe it years ago, but I can't be sure. If I could be sure, I could give credit to them. But I describe it this way. I realized that I was being drawn into the stream of grace. That's the way I describe it. So I was being ushered into, or helped to enter into, the stream of grace, because being in a church service ought to minister grace to us who attend. And I found myself in the stream of grace. And I thoroughly enjoyed the service. I enjoyed the music. I have a particular interest in the music because of my background. The pastor who preached was not the usual pastor, the new pastor that succeeded the man I had read about and have never met. But he did a fine job. There was no problem at all understanding what he had to say, following the truth of what he had to say. And all the way through, I just found myself in the stream of grace. And you know, I've encouraged all of you who listen here to find a church and attend every week. I have regularly said you need to find a church that recognizes and respects the authority of the Bible. You need to find a church that's closest to the Bible, not necessarily closest to your house. I understand you're probably not going to drive 3 hours every Sunday one way to get to a church. I'm not implying that at all. I am forthrightly saying it is important to find a church that respects the authority of the Bible. And I also think that what I discovered about this idea of being in the stream of grace for myself, being on the other side of the pulpit, shall we say, is something else that I would encourage you to consider. Does the church you attend draw you into the stream of grace? That's significant, and I hope you find such a church, because it really does make a huge difference. It did for me. I think it would for you. Well, as I said earlier, there were some things that make my head explode. There were some things this past week. There will always be things, because I notice things. And one of the things that was pointed out to me, I think I had about the same time seen it, but I don't remember exactly, was that there apparently was someone in the media that was decrying the fact that Christians believe their rights come from God. And they were saying that there's something wrong with this, is what they were essentially saying, that people think their rights come from God, not from some government or some other entity. And so naturally my head explodes when I hear that kind of thing, because it is an essential doctrine of being American. Aside from Christian, it's an essential understanding of the American form of government that our rights come from God. So let me read a little bit of the Declaration of Independence so that we understand what I'm talking about. So I'm going to start at the beginning, and then we'll stop partway in. Here it goes. It reads like this, from July 4, 1776. The unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And right there we'll stop. But did you hear it? All men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So from the beginning of the founding of our country, we as a people have asserted and affirmed that our rights come from God. And anybody who says otherwise is simply either trying to undermine the nation or speaking because they don't understand and they haven't read and taken seriously the Declaration of Independence. We are endowed by our Creator with rights that cannot be taken away. That's exactly what is said here. And that's so important. And we who are Christians especially need to affirm that and never, did I say never? I think I did say never. I'm going to say never again. Never back down from that. Our rights come from God. Not every nation believes that. I know that for a certainty. Canada does not have the same understanding of rights coming from God. Now, the Christians there might have that, but by nature of the government, I lived there for a while, I understand it a little bit. By nature of the government, they do not have the same understanding that rights come from God. We in this country must never let that go. We must always affirm that. That's one of the gifts the church has to the nation, is to help people remember that our rights come from God. Now, closely related to that, and I think this is something that too many people have forgotten, closely related to that is the purpose of government. So, let me read part of that, and I'll pick it up and continue just a little bit further to make the next part clear. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Now that last sentence there, that is huge. We form government in this country to secure our rights. That means government is there to work with us to make sure our rights are never violated. Rights, for example, that are spelled out in the Constitution and in the amendments to the Constitution, particularly the 10 known as the Bill of Rights. Government's primary responsibility is to secure our rights, and they get the power to do that from the consent of us, the governed. So this is a fundamental understanding of the government in the United States, and we must never forget that. Do not let anybody talk you out of the idea that our rights come from God and that government, everybody we elect, from whatever level to whatever level in government, they are responsible to secure our rights. That's what we, shall we say, hire them to do. Absolutely significant, absolutely important. All right, a couple other things that have come to my attention that I think we need to touch on a little bit, just so we don't lose track of what is really important and going on in our world. And one of those relates to diversity, equity, and inclusion. You might refer to it as DEI, or you might have heard of it referred to as DEI. Maybe you even wondered what it was about. Well, it's about diversity, equity, and inclusion. Whenever you hear DEI or diversity, equity, and inclusion, that should always get your attention and help you realize this is not something you want to be at all associated with. This is a bad thing. It is going to bring about all kinds of difficulties because what they mean by the people that promote diversity, equity, and inclusion is not what the words sound like. Diversity sounds like a good thing, but what they really mean when they put it into practice is conformity. You will conform to what we want. When they say equity, what they really mean is favoring certain groups or certain people over others because they think they have been out of favor, and so they want to promote them and give them favoritism. And inclusion really means exclusion. It doesn't mean they're going to include you and everybody else. It means you're going to be excluded unless you think the way they want you to think. Now, that's just a brief introduction to that, but it's important for us to pay attention to that, especially those of us who are Christians. Absolutely important for us to understand our times. Well, what got my attention about this was that the University of Florida, a state university in Florida, you've probably heard of the Gators and the football team and whatever else. Well, they eliminated all of their positions that relate to diversity, equity, and inclusion. They did that because to keep them would violate state law. They were quite clear about that. And many of us in Florida celebrated that because we recognized the damage that this ideology related to conformity, favoritism, and exclusion really brings to every situation where it's involved. Well, you may have also noticed that one of their football players who went on to play professionally for the Dallas Cowboys, Emmitt Smith, lost his mind over the fact that they eliminated those positions. And when that happens, I always think, well, that's a good thing. If somebody's losing their mind, then we must be on the right track. And I think you need to be alert to that because this DEI stuff, diversity, equity, inclusion, is creeping in all over the place, including into too many Christian colleges and universities. Whenever you see that, you can be sure someone has compromised on something important, and it's a dangerous road to go down. So I think that's an important thing for Christians to be aware of. We must not overlook that. And then there's one more thing before we take a break. I want to call your attention to, you're well aware, I'm sure, that it's been a huge problem recently that men have been participating in women's athletics. It's been a disaster for women. It's absolutely an insult to women. It's a terrible thing. And I was very encouraged that one of our Wesleyan universities, Houghton University, has a president now that spoke up in defense of women's athletics. And he made a very strong statement about that. And I'd like to read that. I think we have time to get through that, just so you will hear what needs to be said about some of these things. So here from Wayne Lewis, president of Houghton. Biological males' participation in women's athletics is wrong. Most Americans and most of the world know it to be wrong. A fringe agenda under the guise of making school and collegiate athletics more inclusive for transgender people has grown to the place of now unfairly displacing gifted and hardworking female athletes, obliterating the historic achievements and records of female athletes of the past, and threatening to dismantle the opportunities and protection for girls and women in sport trailblazing leaders fought so hard to create and protect. Too many leaders, parents, professional athletes, and people of goodwill have been silent as female athletes are humiliated, silenced, and robbed of hard-earned opportunities. That silence is complicit with a fringe agenda that threatens to dismantle girls' and women's athletics. And I'm going to pause there. There's more to the statement, but do you hear diversity, equity, and inclusion going on here? Yeah, you hear what's going on here. It's exactly what I said. They're excluding people that should be included because they're saying that men should be allowed to participate in women's sports. It's just bizarre. The president goes on to say, I currently serve a Christian university as its president. I believe God has formed each of us, men and women, with intention and purpose. I further believe sex and gender are a divine prerogative and are neither separate from each other nor subject to change. However, my assertion that biological males' participation in women's athletics is wrong is not a Christian position. It is a moral position. While I currently serve a Christian university, most of my career has been in the public sector as a teacher, professor, administrator, and state education chief. If I served in any of those roles again, my position would be the same. Well, good. Let's pause again. I agree with him. And I agree that God did all this. And I agree that they aren't subject to change. He's exactly right, and we celebrate that. It is both a moral position, and I would assert he didn't, that it's a Christian position, because the only moral position is a Christian position. Otherwise, how do we know what right from wrong is? Well, he goes on. Let's finish his statement. Throughout human history and to the present, most of the world and most Americans have upheld the truth that men and women have important distinguishing characteristics. American society is organized based on that understanding. Our organization of sport exists based on the understanding, stating the obvious and widely supported truth that men and women have important biological differences is not a position of hatred or bigotry. It is common sense. While I believe most policy attempts to be inclusive of persons who identify as transgender are well-meaning, I struggle to understand how leaders with the best interest of girls and women at heart could advocate for or endorse practices that not only place female athletes at a competitive disadvantage, but also subject them to disrespect and embarrassment and place them at greater risk for harassment and assault. Enough is enough. I will not sit by silently as a university president whose female student athletes step weekly onto tracks, courts, and fields to compete, but in some cases are forced to do so on playing fields we know to be unfair. I hope you will join me. And I say, right on, President Lewis. That's so important. It's common sense. We have to just stand up and say no to all that stuff. Well, we're going to get into some more things. I hope you'll join us. We're going to keep stretching in God's direction. I'm Pastor Rick. We'll be right back.
The pandemic may be over for some, but millions of Americans are needlessly suffering from the long-haul effects of toxic spike protein from COVID-19 and the vaccines. You've heard Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company discuss the harmful effects of spike protein in your body. And now they found the solution. The miracle enzyme natokinase. Their spike support formula contains natokinase, the most compelling and scientifically supported approach to safely clear spike protein out of the body. What's more, spike support is optimized with other all-natural, non-GMO ingredients, like dandelion root, to help prevent spike protein from binding to your cells. Everyone should take daily spike support so you can feel your best. America Out Loud listeners can go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order.
58 million people suffer from joint aches and stiffness in the U.S. every day. Ignoring chronic joint discomfort can affect mobility and your quality of life. Advanced Nutrition Company, HealthyCell, created joint health and mobility to support connective tissue, joint lubrication, and reduce joint irritation with curcumin, omega-3, chondroitin, glucosamine, and hyaluronic acid for joint comfort and flexible range of motion. And HealthyCell's not a pill. It's a patent-pending gel you swallow with clinically proven ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients. You would need to take 11 pills to get the same amount of nutrients in each gel pack. And these great-tasting gels come in a small packet. Tear off the top, shoot it down, or mix it in water. It's 100% drug-free joint support. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. HealthyCell.com, code out loud for 25% off.
You've all heard Dr. McCullough and others share over and over the value of keeping your sinuses cleansed. It's a smart move all year, but even more so when we're cooped up inside. It's not really open for debate any longer. Those that live smart and live well pay attention to nasal and oral hygiene. Cofix RX has just the tools for the job with our nasal and throat cleanse. Click the Cofix RX banner on AmericaOutloud.shop to get 20% off your entire order. That's right, AmericaOutloud.shop. Use coupon code OUTLOUD. That's coupon code OUTLOUD for 20% off your entire order.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Fight back with Heal Right. Heal Right is a bar you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Take action today. Visit healright.com/outloud or americaoutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Spike proteins help viruses enter into your cells, disrupting your health and your well-being. Global Healing's Foreign Protein Cleanse detoxes your body of spike proteins, which allows your body to repair from within, supporting your immune and respiratory systems, and regulating your inflammatory response. Formulated by Dr. Edward Group and by Dr. Brian Artis, Foreign Protein Cleanse targets and detoxes spike proteins in the body. Go to AmericaOutloud.shop and get 15% off using the code OUTLOUD. Global Healing, giving you the power to take control of your health naturally.
Oral hygiene hasn't changed in 50 years. Brush, floss, repeat. We're told to use fluoride, which doesn't really address the acid-creating bacteria. That is where the dentist-recommended Spry Dental Defense System shines. Spry products contain xylitol, a natural sugar, which helps get rid of those nasty, smelly acid-creating bacteria in our mouth. The best way to care for your teeth and gums is by using Spry. The Spry Dental Defense System has a wide variety of products: toothpaste, mouthwash, mints, and chewing gums that are designed to work together to keep your teeth clean and mouth healthy and smelling sweet all day long. To get your oral care back on track in an easy, effective, and very tasty way, switch to Spry today. Ask your dentist about xylitol and the Spry products. Spry can be found online and at all fine natural product retailers.
ASEA believes that inside each of us is the potential to feel our very best. Our customers will tell you how our products have made a difference for them, from improving immune health and supporting gut health to reducing the appearance of wrinkles and even improving mind, mood, and energy. Make our breakthrough products an essential step in fulfilling your greatest potential. ASEA, we power potential. For exclusive savings, use code OUTLOUD to save 15% off your first order today.
A suppression of truth in a world of darkness, void of any soul, requires that we are rightly informed, properly equipped, and strongly motivated to fight the corruption. AmericaOutloud.news is that place to awaken your heart, soul, and mind to the Out Loud truth. Now is our time. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Well, here we are. We're back. Hope you enjoyed that break. I hope you're still processing all the things we talked about, because we did talk about a lot of things, and we're going to talk about some more things. We're going to put some things in a different perspective than you might have ever thought of them before, because we want to talk about this idea of salvation. And I have a little different, maybe, perspective on it that I want to talk about today. And I want to encourage you to not be put off by that, but to buckle up your spiritual seatbelt and hang in there. We're not going to talk about anything that's weird, strange, or not biblical, but I want us to think maybe in different terms and in a different way, because the idea that Jesus talks about in John chapter 3 when he has this conversation with Nicodemus is very significant. And if we want to find our way into the kingdom of heaven, if we want to find ourselves made new, if we want to find ourselves saved, we need to understand what God is talking about. And some people, I'm afraid, have gotten the wrong idea about what this means. And they're headed in a way that they will not like when it all gets put together at the end. So I want to start with an article that I came across recently, written by a man named Tom Rainer. And its title is quite interesting. And it's almost hard to explain, but I think you'll understand it. It's just kind of, when I look at it, I go, what is that? But the title is The Crino, Christian in Name Only. And I don't know how he pronounces C-H-R-I-N-O. I pronounced it Crino because of Christian, Crino. And he talks about being Christians in name only. Now, I've heard, you probably have heard, the expression in the political realm of Republicans in name only, or RINOs. And then you sometimes hear that in other situations, too. I heard someone refer to an attorney general as an agino, attorney general in name only, because they weren't doing the job this person thought they should. Well, Tom Rainer here is talking about people who are Christian in name only. Maybe they just want to call themselves Christian because it's convenient. Maybe he says they don't understand. And he doesn't approach this from a point of judgment, and neither do I. It's not my responsibility or intent to judge. My responsibility and intent here is to hold up what salvation means and invite you in. And I think that's what he's all about, too, because he's concerned that maybe people just don't understand what it means to be a Christian. So he starts out by citing research that points out that 7 out of 10 American adults self-identify as Christian. That's 69%. That's a large percentage. So he says, when you consider adults as 18 years or older, we have 259 million people. That's based on census information, he says. And so he comes to the number that 179 people in this country self-identify as Christian. That's a lot of people. That's 60%. That's well over half. But he asks the question, are these people genuinely Christian? Do they understand what it means to be genuinely Christian? Do they understand what Jesus said in John chapter 3, verse 3? I tell you the truth, unless you are born again, you cannot see the kingdom of God. Do they really understand what that means? how many of these people, he asked, are Christian in name only? And he asked that question because he thinks, believes, and I think he's right, that we need to recognize this, because those of us who are ministers of the gospel have a responsibility to help people understand what it means to be a Christian. He admits, I admit, we can't know what's in the hearts of people. I don't pretend to know that. I don't pretend to pronounce judgment on you or anyone else, whether you're a Christian. I simply want to say, here's what Jesus had to say about it. Are you following him in the way he described here? Well, Rainer goes on to analyze the numbers. He's kind of a numbers guy in a lot of ways, and I respect what he's done. And he tries to complete an exercise because he wants to try to identify, and he thinks he can, and he provides the rationale and then the conclusion. He's come to the conclusion of how many people he thinks are really Christians in name only, who as a part of church members, but then he says in terms of the general population, how many are Christians in name only. So he comes to this conclusion. I conservatively estimate, he writes, that at least 40% of church members are Christians in name only. That's a pretty big number. 40% of church members, Christians in name only. That's an interesting conclusion, and he gives the rationale for that. And if you want to look up the article, that's fine. We won't go into those details. That's not important for us right now. But he also goes on to say, among the general population of self-identifying Christians, I estimate that 60% are Christians in name only. Well, for those of us who are concerned that people understand the way, the truth, and the life, that people understand what it means to find Christ and to be a Christian, that's alarming. That's a big number. And I want us to take a look at John chapter 3 and think about what Jesus had to say to Nicodemus here so that we can begin to understand what does it mean to be a Christian. We don't want to be Christians in name only. We want to be faithful followers of Christ who give allegiance to him and live a life that reflects the life of Jesus, that reflects how we cooperate with his grace and we follow the unforced rhythms of grace, as I sometimes refer to it from Matthew chapter 11, as translated by Eugene Peterson in The Message. Well, let's take a look at John chapter 3 and this encounter with Nicodemus. Nicodemus was a Pharisee. It's important to kind of understand where he's coming from. What that means is that he was part of this group that was concerned with covenant faithfulness, and they had a particular perspective on what they thought it meant to live in conformity to the covenant or to keep the righteous requirements of the law, we might say, for them to be faithful to the covenant, because they were covenant partners with God and they understood they had a responsibility to keep the covenant. So Pharisees were concerned about that, and they had their particular understanding of what that meant. He was also a member of the Jewish ruling council. Well, it says Jewish ruling council in here, and we'll read that. That's referring to the Sanhedrin. So these were important people in Judaism who held high positions of responsibility and who should understand what it means to follow God faithfully, and who should have understood and recognized the coming of Messiah, but Nicodemus clearly struggled. And so Jesus is trying to help him. Jesus is not trying to condemn Nicodemus. And it goes on to say later in the verse in chapter 17, in the chapter and verse, in chapter 3, verse 17, it goes on to say that Jesus didn't come to condemn the world, but came to save the world. Well, in reality, if he wanted to condemn the world, he didn't need to come at all. So it should be obvious that because of his coming, he came to save the world. So let's unpack what Jesus says to Nicodemus, and particularly it relates to that very common phrase of, you must be born again. Now, this English translation doesn't use all of the same words you might be familiar with, but listen to the concepts. That's what's important here. The exact words aren't important. What Jesus is trying to teach us is what matters. So Mark chapter 3, beginning with verse 1, I'm reading from the New English Translation. Now, a certain man, a Pharisee named Nicodemus, who was a member of the Jewish ruling council, came to Jesus at night and said to him, Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher who has come from God, for no one can perform the miraculous signs that you do unless God is with him. Jesus replied, I tell you the solemn truth. Unless a person is born from above, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Nicodemus said to him, How can a man be born when he is old? He cannot enter his mother's womb and be born a second time, can he? Jesus answered, I tell you the solemn truth, unless a person is born of water and spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. What is born of the flesh is flesh. What is born of the spirit is spirit. Do not be amazed that I said to you, you must all be born from above. The wind blows wherever it will, and you hear the sound it makes, but do not know where it comes from and where it is going. So it is with everyone who is born of the Spirit. Nicodemus replied, How can these things be? Jesus answered, Are you the teacher of Israel, and yet you don't understand these things? I tell you the solemn truth. We speak about what we know and testify about what we have seen, but you people do not accept our testimony. If I had told you people about earthly things and you don't believe, how will you believe if I tell you about heavenly things? No one has ascended into heaven except the one who descended from heaven, the Son of Man. Just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, so that everyone who believes in him may have eternal life. For this is the way God loved the world. He gave his one and only Son, so that everyone who believes in him will not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world should be saved through him. The one who believes in him is not condemned. The one who does not believe has been condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the one and only Son of God. Now this is the basis for judging, that the light has come into the world, and the people loved the darkness rather than the light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil deeds hates the light and does not come to the light, so that their deeds will not be exposed. But the one who practices the truth comes to the light, so that it may be plainly evident that his deeds have been done in God. Now that's hugely important, that last part there. That's hugely important because Jesus said, now this is the basis for judging, that's verse 19, that the light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light because their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil deeds hates the light and does not come to the light so that their deeds will not be exposed. But the one who practices the truth comes to the light so that it may be plainly evident that his deeds have been done in God. Very significant there. We'll get to that a little bit more as we get into this. But notice that Nicodemus comes to Jesus at night. And there have been a number of explanations for that idea that he came at night. Some people think he just didn't want to be seen with Jesus. Maybe. I don't know. Other people think that, well, it's a good description and a good contrast because Jesus brings up this difference between darkness and light. And so he comes in the night, in the dark, to the light of Jesus. Well, I like the way that the Bible uses these kind of image things that appeal to our imagination, and they kind of communicate to us on a way that's not necessarily straightforward, but helps us think through this and appeals a little bit to our imagination. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think we have to be careful that we're rooted in the scripture and what the Bible says, but I think the idea of the imagination being profoundly guided by this imaginative use of words and descriptions helps us grasp what Jesus is talking about. So let's unpack this a little bit. Jesus talking to Nicodemus. Nicodemus acknowledges that Jesus comes from God, but struggles when Jesus begins to explain things to him because he can't quite get it. Even though he says Jesus speaks, comes from God. So the first thing we should wrestle with, and this is again, put on your spiritual seatbelt because some people really struggle with this, but I think it's important for us in our day to really come to grips with this. First thing I want us to think about is that salvation is not following a formula and getting the expected result. In science class in high school, I had to follow a formula step by step for these science experiments. And I remember one time I was very careful. I thought I had done everything right, but I still didn't get the expected result. I tried to follow the formula, but I didn't get there. Well, salvation is not following a formula. Sometimes people think, well, you have to pray a certain prayer in a certain way, and that makes you a Christian. I beg to differ because nowhere in the scriptures does Jesus say that. He talks here about looking to him, and the Bible talks in other places about following Jesus, but it never talks about a prescribed prayer. That's a formula. In fact, I think that we've come to this idea of formula both for convenience to help us understand, and I get that, and that's useful. But when we make salvation a formula, it reduces it to less than it is. The danger, or the mistake, we might say, is that we concentrate so much on avoiding hell that we miss heaven, or maybe better said, we miss the extent of salvation. You see, we think that salvation, as long as we have enough Jesus to avoid hell, that's okay. But that's not what Jesus talks about. He wants to talk about a whole new life that does the kinds of things that demonstrate faithfulness to him, that demonstrate a changed life, and that results one day, culminates one day in a new heaven where we will live with him and his people forever. That is way beyond a formula to keep us out of hell. So we need to think about that, and we need to come to grips with salvation is more than and cannot be reduced to a formula. It's not a formula. Salvation, you see, secondly, is significant change. That might be what Nicodemus was struggling with. Don't know exactly, but we have good hints at that, because as a teacher in Israel, he would have understood that when a Gentile converted to Judaism, they were considered or thought of like a newborn child. They were starting life brand new because they converted from whatever they had been believing before to Judaism, and so they understood this is a newborn child in the Jewish faith. They also understood that legally, during Roman times, under Roman law, if a son was adopted into a new family, that son gave up all of their past legal status from the other family. So they started life all over again in the new family. So there were some cultural and some legal things that would have pointed out that this was something new. But somehow, to Nicodemus, it doesn't occur to him until Jesus points it out that a Jewish person needs to have a conversion into following Jesus, and that the true faith of Israel was found in culmination in the person and work of Jesus, and that this was a transforming process that made them new. Now, to be sure, they had indications of that in the prophets. For example, Ezekiel, and you may have heard this, Ezekiel says, or quotes God as saying, "I will sprinkle you with pure water, and you will be clean from all your impurities. I will purify you from all your idols. I will give you a new heart, and I will put a new spirit within you. I will remove the heart of stone from your body and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit within you. I will take the initiative, and you will obey my statutes and carefully observe my regulations." So Jesus is talking about that very idea when he says to Nicodemus, you have to be born of water and spirit. In other words, Jesus says you got to be a person, and you got to be a person made new by the coming of the Spirit, making you new from the inside out. It's a real conversion. It's a real encounter with a real God. You see, they understood that in the Jewish context because they understood the importance of cleansing. And they regularly practiced different types of rituals for cleansing. For example, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we learn something about the Qumran community. And if you visit Israel, and I hope you can someday, you might be able to visit Qumran. And when you stand there and you look at the excavated area of this Qumran community, you will see what looks like a cistern. And you will see steps that you can go down into the cistern and steps then that you can come back up out of the cistern. That was built for ritual cleansing because they understood that this idea of immersion in water would cleanse someone. In fact, when a Gentile was converted, they would be immersed in water, and they thought of that as removing the Gentile impurity. So Nicodemus really should have understood in a certain way what Jesus was talking about. He just couldn't quite get all the way around that until Jesus explained that it's both this idea that you understand of cleansing or of being a human and having cleansed yourself as a change from Gentile to Jew, but you need to understand that the same thing is true when you change to a believer in me. There is a real significant conversion change, and they shouldn't get away from that. And he should have Nicodemus should have been able to grasp that. Now, we don't know what conclusion Nicodemus came from, came to. We just know what Jesus challenged him with and what we now need to wrestle with. So salvation is not a formula. It's not something that you do that you get a certain result. It's a significant change. Salvation is a legal change in terms of forgiveness of sins, but it's more than that because it's being made new by the energizing spirit of the living Christ. And so conversion is a real change. And it's important to point out that it's Jesus that saves, or Jesus that effects this change. Now, interestingly enough, Jesus again gives Nicodemus an image to help him wrestle with what he's teaching him. And he gives him the image of Moses in the wilderness. Well, when the people of God left Egypt, Moses led them through the wilderness, and God provided for them in miraculous ways, including giving them manna every morning to eat. That was a substance that's hard for us to explain, but God provided it every day so they would have something to eat and survive. Well, that is not too much of a statement to say this is a bunch of complainers, because regularly they complained about one thing or another. And at one point in Numbers chapter 21, we read the story of how they complained, and they complained about manna. They were tired of that, and they didn't hold back, shall we say, in their feelings about that. Well, God responded to that by sending among them poisonous, venomous snakes. And the snakes would bite the people, and the people would die. And finally, the people got the hint, shall we say. Maybe that's a too casual way of saying it, but they realized that God had sent the serpents, and they needed to change. And so they cried out to Moses. They repented before God, said they'd been wrong about all that. And God said to Moses, okay, make a serpent and put that serpent up on a pole. And Jesus talked about that the serpent was lifted up, and everybody, when according to God's instructions, when they looked at the serpent Moses had made, they would be healed from the snake bites. It's kind of a miraculous thing when you think about it, really remarkable. Well, Jesus said in the same way that they were healed from the venom, the poison of that bite, we can be healed when we look to Jesus. When he is lifted up, and it also refers, of course, to the cross, that when Jesus is lifted up, then we can look to Jesus and we can live. There's an old song, look and live, look to Jesus now and live. Well, that's the point that Nicodemus is hearing Jesus say, and that we need to hear Jesus say too. It's that Jesus saves. Now, what does it mean to be saved? Well, it means a lot of things, and it's described in a lot of ways, and it's confirmed by the witness of the Spirit in the life of the believer. I don't think it's a formula, and I think you can know when you've done it, because if you're resisting Jesus, you know it. But it's Jesus comes and makes a significant change in us. Maybe we should think of it as a do-over. Jesus comes and gives us a second chance at life. So maybe you've had some regrets in your life. Maybe you wish you had behaved differently in a certain situation, but you can't go back and change it. Maybe you said some things in certain situations and you can't go back and say it and change it. You can't say it again. It's impossible to turn the clock back. Maybe you've been hurt by somebody or something. Maybe people didn't keep their promises to you. Maybe somebody betrayed you. Maybe you have been lied about. Maybe a lot of things could result in you being hurt in life. That's kind of a general term. But you know that you have been. Or maybe you recognize that you've failed. Maybe you made some promises to some people and you just didn't live up to them. Maybe you made some promises to yourself and you didn't live up to them. And you just have a lot of looking back and you say, man, I've really messed up. Well, being born again or born from above is the recognition that when you come to Jesus, you get the chance to have a do-over, because your life can be made new and you no longer have to be defined by the regrets or by the things that you've done, by the failures, by anything that happened in the past, because the idea of being born from above is being born to start life brand new. It means you're different. It's not a formula that you pray. It's a life you embrace, because Jesus said that what we need to do is we need to cooperate with the unforced rhythms of grace. It's not a force Jesus doesn't come and say, you better do this. You have to do this. I'm going to coerce you into doing this. No, he says, this is what you need to do to find life. Cooperate with the unforced rhythms of grace. Work with me. Follow what I do. Live the way I live. That's what it means for salvation. So that when he sums up at the end and said, and describes the deeds done in the darkness versus the deeds done in the light, he's very clearly saying that when we find him and when we discover salvation, when we are born from above, when we are born again, we live differently. We do different things. We are no longer the people we once were. How many people get trapped into thinking salvation is formulaic, and yet they find that their life hasn't changed? It's because they have believed and maybe been improperly taught that if they just simply pray a prayer, that solves everything. Praying a prayer is fine. It's an entry to saying, my life is going to be different because I'm going to follow Jesus and do what he did and speak the way he spoke and to order my life according to the scriptures so that my life reflects love for God with my heart, soul, mind, and strength, and I love my neighbor as myself. It is a profoundly new life, and Jesus makes you new so you can be that new. I invite you to trust him. I'm Pastor Rick. We'll be back next week.